Welcome back to The Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. Today, we're really diving into the world of infectious disease control. But not just the diseases themselves. We're actually tearing open the official source material to look at the intense protocols, you know, the stuff public health and frontline folks like paramedics use every day to manage risk and stop transmission.
Exactly. Our mission here is to sort of pull back the curtain on that operational safety net. I mean, when you look at the system keeping communicable diseases contained, it's really this complex web. Mandated procedures, special roles, even specific chemicals. We're digging out the surprising details, the crucial rules that make sure, you know, a provider's exposure doesn't turn into something bigger.
Okay, before we get into all the rules, let's just quickly define what we're dealing with. A communicable disease is just an infectious disease passed person to person.
Mm-hmm. Simple definition, yeah. But the complexity comes in how we track them. Public health departments, both state and local, use these three key levels. Lowest level is endemic. Right. That means the disease is just kind of normally found in an area, like seasonal flu, maybe.
Right, predictable.
Then you've got epidemic. That's a sudden jump in cases, way more than expected. Alarming, usually.
And the big one everyone knows now, pandemic.
Yeah.
That's gone global, affecting huge numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
Those three levels really drive everything, surveillance, resources, the whole response.
It totally connects the big agency rules right down to how individuals stay safe.
Right. So if regulations are part one, where do these rules actually come from?
Yeah.
We need to unpack the national oversight piece. Looks like two big players here, OSHA and the CDC.
Yeah. OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they're all about the employee. They set really strict rules, like the bloodborne pathogen standard that covers PPE use, hazard communication, things like that. And more broadly, there's the general duty clause. It's basically a catch-all saying employers have to protect staff from known serious hazards. It's this big safety umbrella.
Okay, so OSHA is the enforcer for worker safety. Meanwhile, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they're like the intelligence agency.
Ah, yeah, something like that. They gather the data, do the research, publish the guidelines, best practices for everything from washing your hands to vaccine schedules. That often comes from the CDC.
But you mentioned something else, a specific act.
Oh, right, the Ryan White Care Act. This one often flies under the public radar, but it's absolutely critical for EMS.
What's interesting there is how it locks in that communication channel about exposure. It actually mandates that hospitals must tell emergency crews if a patient they brought in gets diagnosed with a specific transmitted disease.
Exactly. It means the provider who is potentially exposed isn't left wondering. They get notified so they can get follow-up care. It's a vital link, legally and ethically, between the hospital and the field team.
Which leads us right to paramedics, the boots on the ground. Their job isn't just patient care. It's also actively preventing these healthcare-associated infections.
Absolutely. That means things like keeping up with required vaccines. Hep B is a big one, and following work restriction rules. If they're sick, they stay home. Simple as that. But the real deep dive, operationally, is the cleaning.
Right. The sources talk about equipment classification dictating how intense the cleaning needs to be. Three classes.
Yep. Non-critical equipment just touches intact skin, think stethoscopes, BP cuffs. Semi-critical touches mucous membranes, like nebulizer masks. And critical equipment, that goes into sterile tissue or the bloodstream, 5E catheters, intubation blades, that sort of thing.
So critical stuff needs full sterilization complex, time-consuming. Non-critical just needs good cleaning and disinfection. That classification makes a huge difference in how quickly they can turn the ambulance around.
Oh, definitely. And even the routine cleaning. For non-critical items, it's intense. You've got to properly toss contaminated linens, medical waste, wash down surfaces, and crucially, clean the stretcher with a specific germicidal, virucidal solution. Plus, really focus on those high-touch items, door handles, radio mics, screens. It's relentless.
That focus on the process is what makes it professional practice, not just standard care. Okay, so we've got the rules. Now, the mechanics. If a provider gets exposed, what determines if they actually get sick? Looks like four factors.
First is dose. How much of the organism were you exposed to? A tiny bit versus a large amount matters. Second, virulence. How strong is the bug? How easily does it cause disease?
Third, the mode of entry. Did it splash in your eye, get into a cut? Did you breathe it in? And fourth, this is a big variable. The health status of the host. Are you vaccinated, immunocompromised, generally healthy? All four need to align, really.
And these diseases spread through five main ways. Most common is contact, can be direct touching someone infected or indirect touching a contaminated doorknob, say.
Then you have droplet transmission, bigger particles from coughs, sneezes. And the really tricky one, airborne transmission, where tiny particles hang in the air.
Right. And last is vector transmission. Think mosquito or kick bites. So given all these risks, what's the absolute fundamental defense? We talk PPE gloves, eyewear, gowns, masks, but the sources are clear. The number one thing, the primary protective measure,
has to be hand hygiene.
Absolutely. Because contamination often happens through the hands before you even realize you need all the other gear. And speaking of PPE, surgical masks stop droplets, yeah. But if you use N95 or P100 respirators for airborne stuff, federal law says you need a whole respiratory protection program, fit testing, medical checks, the works.
Here's something really interesting. Needle stick safety. The Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act. That really changed things in the field, didn't it?
Oh, massively. It mandated safer tech needle-safe systems, needleless systems for IVs.
It forced a huge design and logistics shift. Providers have to use these safer devices and immediately put used sharps into proper disposal containers. No exceptions. Takes the risk right out.
But sometimes prevention fails and exposure happens. That's where the designated infection control officer, the DICO, comes in. That's your third line of defense.
And it sounds like a really sensitive role.
It is. The DICO manages incredibly confidential medical information. They make sure the exposed employee gets the right treatment and counseling. They track compliance, maintain confidentiality, and they act as the only go-between for the employee and the hospital about the patient's status.
Wait, so even if I know who the patient was, and I know I got stuck with their needle, I don't get their test results directly. The DICO controls that flow.
Precisely. It's designed to protect the patient's privacy while making absolutely sure the provider gets the info they need fast. And the protocol after a bloodborne exposure needle stick, blood splash in the eye or mouth, certain bites, it's very specific.
The source patient has to be tested for a whole panel of diseases.
That's right. HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and syphilis. The DICO gets those results confidentially and then must release them to the exposed employee. Timeliness is critical for starting preventative treatment if needed. The whole system relies on the DIC doing their job correctly.
Okay, let's shift gears. Look at some specific pathogens. Starting with sepsis, that sounds terrifying.
Sepsis isn't the infection itself, remember. It's the body's overreaction to an infection, like hitting the self-destruct button, leading to organ failure, shock. Recognizing it fast is key. Frontline crews often use a quick scoring tool. The quick sepsis-related organ failure assessment, or QSOFA.
QSOFA, like a quick warning light. Based on things like breathing rate, mental status, blood pressure, helps spot the really high-risk patients quickly.
Exactly. Cuts through the noise to prioritize getting help. Okay, now respiratory threats. Tuberculosis, TB, airborne transmission. The worry isn't just TB itself, but the resistant strains. MDR-TB, multi-drug resistant, and the even worse XDR-TB, extensively drug resistant.
And certain groups are higher risk. People from Asia, incarcerated or homeless populations, immunocompromised folks.
Correct. We also need to mention pertussis whooping cough. Violent coughing fits, yes, but the classic sign you listen for is that high-pitched whoop sound when they gasp for air afterwards. Unmistakable.
And of course, COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
Emerged late 2019, pandemic by 2020. We know it spreads easily through respiratory droplets, direct contact, contaminated surfaces.
Assessment signs included fever, muscle aches, chills, and those really distinct ones, loss of smell or taste.
Okay, let's talk hepatitis. Big occupational concern, 5 types, A, B, C, D, E, hepatitis B, HBV. Seems like a primary threat for providers.
Definitely. Transmitted through sexual contact, blood, contaminated needles. That's why the Hep B vaccine is so important for healthcare workers. Chronic HBV, serious risks, cirrhosis, liver cancer down the road.
Hepatitis C, HCV, mainly through shared needles, needle sticks. But there's some hope there. A vaccine in trials.
Yes, currently in human clinical trials, which is promising news for future protection. And we can't forget Hep A and E. Those are usually spread through the fecal-oral route, which just brings us back again to basic, meticulous hand washing and glove use. Foundational stuff.
Okay. Vector-borne disease is now ticks and mosquitoes, Zika virus that came with some serious warnings.
Zika's tricky. Mosquito bite, yes, but also sexual transmission from male to partner and the huge concern, mother to fetus transmission causing microcephaly, plus that link to Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS.
Then Lyme disease, most common tick-borne illness in the U.S. Here's a specific detail. The sources say post-exposure antibiotics after just a tick bite are not usually recommended.
That's right. Unlike some other bacterial exposures, routine preventative treatment isn't standard practice for a tick bite alone. That often surprises people.
And Ebola. Severe viral hemorrhagic fever. Transmission needs direct contact, broken skin, or mucous membranes. Requires really high-level precautions, standard droplet, and contact.
But for decontamination, the virus is actually pretty fragile. Common stuff like household bleach can kill it.
Which leads us right into our final section, and it's a concerning one. Resistance. Bacteria that fight back, especially those spore formers that change the cleaning game entirely.
Yeah, the overuse and misuse of antibiotics worldwide has pushed us here. Pathogens evolving resistance. And an interesting, maybe controversial point from the sources, sometimes patients with these resistant bugs might fall under ADA protections, adding complexity for employers.
Let's hit the big three resistant organisms.
Yeah.
First, MRSA methicillin-resistant Staph aureus spreads mainly via unwashed hands.
And the key operational point, for MRSA skin infections, treatment is often just incision and drainage. Antibiotics aren't always the first or best step, which goes against common thinking.
Second, VRE vancomycin-resistant enterococci, mostly seen in hospitals, causing UTIs, surgical site infections, but field providers still need to be aware.
And third, the spore formers, the really tough ones. C. difficile, Clostridioides difficile, causes terrible watery diarrhea because it forms spores, alcohol hand gels, useless. You need soap and water for hands and for services. You absolutely need a chlorine-based solution. Standard disinfectants won't cut it.
Same deal for CRE, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, another spore former nightmare.
Exactly the same challenge, chlorine-based cleaner for surfaces. And for your hands, it must be soap and water. Foam and gel won't kill the spores.
Wow, we've gone from huge federal agencies all the way down to the specific type of bleach needed for a C. diff cleanup. The level of detail in these protocols really shows how seriously this is all taken.
It absolutely does. And the key takeaway, I think, is that preparedness really hangs on following these strict mandated procedures.
Right.
From basic hand washing right up to the DICO's legal role. Being protected isn't about luck. It's about rigorous compliance.
So, as you think about all this, here's something to mull over. With diseases like MDR and XDR tuberculosis becoming more common, how will public health agencies have to keep changing the definition of standard precautions in the next decade? Will today's baseline rules even be enough?